Hello, this is Marshall Riddle from MCUL, welcoming Brian C. Smith, Executive Vice President of Sales at Healthcare Insight. With that introduction, let's begin the question and answers. Brian, how can it be so easy to rip off federal healthcare programs?
Well, Marshall, it's a sad fact that particularly in areas such as durable medical equipment and HIV testing, these areas are wide open for abuse. And in fact, in some areas, for example, in South Florida, over a couple of years of focus on just the DME problem, they've seen the amount of DME submitted bills go down $1.7 billion, meaning that upwards of 50 to 60% of all DME claims in South Florida were pure fraud. And unfortunately, you simply need to get a Medicare ID number, buy some black market names of Medicare recipients and providers, and just start the printing press going. So if you think about the other component of that is that if you're going to defraud a payer, you're going to go to where the easiest, most likely, and highest dollars are. And those are in federal programs, federal and state programs like Medicare, like Medicaid, as opposed to commercial health insurers who are investing a fair amount of dollars in really getting after and fighting fraud and abuse.
And what is the commercial health plan market segment doing differently than the federal segment?
Good question. First of all, they are investing resources to really fight this matter, as opposed to the federal side, which has about a $1.8 billion investment in fraud, waste, and abuse on an annual basis. That primarily goes to Department of Justice, Office of Inspector General, and Medicaid fraud units. The amount of dollars that the federal government has recaptured, you know, is in the $2.5 to $2.8 billion range. That's as opposed to look at the Blues, for example, that just reported recently that across their 100 million members, and that's what the 39 Blues plans represent, they're able to recover $516 million. That works out to about 43 cents per member per month. That is, if you put that over to the federal side, that would be a much bigger yield. I think the other important piece is that we're seeing our customers move away from the idea of pay and chase. In other words, pay the claim quick and then go back retrospectively to try to identify what are either overpayments or actual fraud. Our customers are doing this on a prospective basis. In other words, we're looking at literally all of their claims up front every night. We have history of those providers over a couple of years as well, sometimes up to 5 years, and we can identify various different schemes and various different profiles of these providers and stop that claim payment from leaving the door up front. That produces a tremendously higher yield, and those dollars never leave the claim shop. And that's an important fact. So this movement, I think, that we're seeing in the commercial segment is something that would be incredibly profitable from a return on investment standpoint on the federal side. They just have not embraced that level of technology or the level of resources needed to invest and to make that happen.
What is the predominant tactic for fighting fraud today? What will it look like tomorrow?
Well, As I just mentioned, the predominant tactic is pay and chase, and that's a function of, particularly on the federal side, where they have fiscal intermediaries who actually are doing the payment across the United States. They have very little, if no incentive whatsoever, for or capability, for that matter, to stop a payment before it leaves the door. There are also other types of payer entities, third-party administrators, administrative services only or self-administered plans that, again, are doing just a cursory job at looking backwards retrospectively to identify these types of schemes. The best and the most efficient way is when clients and payer customers are, before they send these payments out, are looking at the various types of patterns that they're seeing from these particular providers, comparing those providers to other specialties or other specialists within that particular provider range. In other words, you're comparing an orthopedic surgeon to an orthopedic surgeon, not an orthopedic surgeon to a general practitioner. And what you see is just a very, very clear area where either these particular providers are unbundling their services. It should be a global type of procedure, but in fact it's been taken down to six or seven different codes. And if you do that once or twice or once in a blue moon, that's usually just a mistake. But if you continually, compared to the rest of your peers, are billing in a manner that is fraught with unbundling or overcoding or upcoding or incorrect type of coding, that's a pattern. And that's where our customers are stopping those kind of claims to be paid to be actually clinically verified. And that's one of the big issues that for us is that we actually have clinical investigators who, once the system identifies what those patterns are, our clinical analysts drill down very deeply into those particular providers, and we provide a very detailed report to our customers and recommended action for them to take.
What is the difference between fraud and abuse?
Well, think of it, Marshall, in a continuum. On the far right side, fraud is a legal definition, which is an intent to bill or charge for something that wasn't delivered. That is, you know, the examples of those, I think everyone has seen kind of the perp walks that they've had in Detroit and Florida where they've gone down, and again, primarily focused on durable medical equipment. They will find fictitious entities that are creating bills and just ripping off Medicare or Medicaid. You'll also have seen schemes where there are actually people recruiting patients off of the street, literally, who have insurance coverage, flying them into a state, having some type of surgery done, actual surgery done, and then billing for a whole host of other services. That was about a $53 million fraud that was perpetrated in Orange County, California, that is now working its way through the legal system. But those are the exceptions. Those are, you know, there's about 1-2% of the providers, and remember, there's over 1 million providers in the United States, and I use the term, you know, generally in terms of professionals and institutions and facilities. Those are all providers to the healthcare system. But in the middle is this abuse area, and there's far more dollars involved there, where very aggressive billing habits are seen. And again, comparing this particular type of billing pattern to the normal billing pattern shows that these types of providers are 2 or 3 standard deviations more aggressive in how they bill. And there are areas, for example, like modifier abuse, which is where a particular code is billed for, then a modifier is attached to it, where that person would receive additional reimbursements for that particular modifier, but they do it almost every time. And that's abusing the reimbursement process to maximize revenue for the particular provider. And that's where we see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of abuse from our customers. And we stop it cold.
Now, if you were the Secretary of Health and Human Services for a day and could do only one thing to impact healthcare fraud and abuse, what would it be?
Well, that would be a fun day for me. The new Patient Protection Affordability Act has just begun to start the idea around actually doing very deep credit checks and criminal history checks on new durable medical equipment suppliers. They've also put a moratorium out that no additional DME suppliers will be added, and they'll have some ability to have a deep review of the billing habits for those entities for the first year. So that's a small start, and that's very low-hanging fruit. If I was king for a day, what I would do is create legislation that allows all Medicare fiscal intermediaries and all Medicaid states to prospectively not pay a claim that they suspect of abuse or of fraud. That's what we do in the commercial sector. That gets by far the biggest return on investment. But today, you know, the whole trade-off always has been in Medicare and Medicaid that the unit reimbursement amount is low relative to the commercial segment. So if Medicaid reimburses a dollar, Medicare reimburses a $1.10 or a $1.15, and a commercial payer reimburses a $1.50. The thought here is that by paying all of the Medicare and Medicaid claims very quickly, that makes up for the fact that it's a lower unit cost. Well, that's really short-sighted if you think about it. If, in fact, you're paying for millions and millions and millions of claims that you should never have paid in the first place, it doesn't matter if the unit cost is low. It becomes very cumbersome and very expensive to go back in time, to retrospectively do audits, and then the hard part, Marshall, is to actually go and collect it. And that's what we hear from Medicaid agencies around the country, that, yeah, they can identify using software and different types of techniques, but the problem is getting that dollar back in the door is very inefficient, very expensive, and at the end of the day doesn't produce the type of returns that are anywhere near if you did this on a prospective basis.
Thanks, Brian. You've been listening to Brian C. Smith answer questions about his Predictive Modeling Web Summit presentation. His complete presentation is available on the Healthcare Web Summit event site.